a new law in Illinois set a national standard to end killings and torture by police. We'll talk to attorney Flint Taylor, who has been revealing what is criminal in the criminal justice system for more than 45 years. Also, voices of heroes, not looters, after Hurricane Katrina. All that and more coming up next. And welcome to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition for September 3rd, 2015 on 89.3 WPFW, your Pacifica listener-powered station for jazz and justice in the nation's capital. On the Ground and onthegroundshow.org are devoted to coverage of social justice activists and activists here in the DMV, the nation, and around the planet. I'm Esther Averman. I want to first thank all our listeners who helped us make our goal during the 2 weeks of the summer mini drive. I didn't have a chance to thank you during the show, so I want to thank Philip, Bonnie, Minerva, Charlotte, Michael, Avery, Leslie, and Jacob. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And remember, you can always become a member of this listener-powered station by calling 202-588-9739 or by pledging online at wpfw.org. To show your support for this show, make sure you mention or select Thursday's Community Watch and Comment from the drop-down menu. Now, today we're going to explore whether a new law in Illinois can set a national standard to end murders, torture, and misconduct by the police. We'll talk to attorney Flint Taylor, who has been on the front lines, on the ground for decades, litigating police violence and government misconduct. From the time when Black Panther Fred Hampton was assassinated by the Chicago police to now, when that city has been forced to pay reparations to victims of police torture. We'll also hear voices of heroes, not looters, after Hurricane Katrina. So, as always, we have a lot for you in this less than an hour, starting with our headlines. A Baltimore judge on Wednesday denied motions aimed at removing state's attorney Marilyn Mosby and dismissing charges against six police officers charged in the death of Freddie Gray. But Judge Barry G. Williams did grant a motion for the six officers to be tried separately. Gray died in April, a week after suffering a spinal injury in custody of the police. His death led to protests and an uprising that prompted the deployment of the National Guard and the mayor to declare a citywide curfew. Outside the courthouse yesterday, there was a small crowd of protesters that marched to Baltimore's Inner Harbor, where one protester, Kwame Rose, was struck by a car, but then was handcuffed and arrested by police, who also pointed a taser at him in what those gathered called excessive force by the large deployment of police in riot gear. Civil rights attorney A. Dwight Pettit told the Real News Network that the public pretrial motions include the request by the defense for a change of venue outside of the city and added his view of the impact of video on these cases.
The case is removed from Baltimore City to any other jurisdiction except Prince George's County, then I think the case is over. And they're arguing that publicity, and with that publicity, the defense has been so prejudiced that you can't find an impartial jury in Baltimore City. And I think that insults the intelligence of the citizenry of Baltimore City. Until the event of technology and cameras and what have you, there was just basically outright open season murder on particularly young black men.
In the latest police brutality case in Texas, the American Civil Liberties Union and a congressman have issued statements on the fatal shooting of Gilbert Flores by two Bexar County Sheriff's Office deputies. The deputy shot and killed Flores Friday while responding to a domestic disturbance report. Representative Joaquin Castro, Democrat of Texas, said, quote, "The encounter is extremely disturbing as it appears to show an unarmed man with his hands up being shot by a deputy. This incident is further evidence that police officers and deputies should wear body cameras. The widely supported technology brings transparency and accountability that protects law enforcement and civilians alike," end quote. Bexar County police officials said yesterday that Flores was holding a knife in one hand. In Virginia, a mentally ill African-American man has been found dead in his jail cell after he spent 4 months behind bars for allegedly stealing $5 worth of food from a 7-Eleven. The Guardian reports that Jamichael Mitchell was arrested by Portsmouth police back in April for allegedly stealing a Mountain Dew, a Snickers bar, and a pastry. A judge had ordered Mitchell's transfer to a mental hospital, but when there were no beds available, he was kept behind bars without bail. He was found dead August 19th. His family believes he starved to death after refusing medication and food in jail. He was 24 years old. This report from The Guardian is part of that newspaper's continuing reporting project called The Counted, which, as we highlighted last month, documents all cases of people killed by the police in the U.S. John Swain, a senior reporter with The Guardian, told WPFW's What's at Stake about another Virginia case of death at the hands of police that has received little attention.
A case in Southern Virginia, a young man called William Chapman, he too was an unarmed black 18-year-old. He too engaged in a brief struggle with a police officer. This one was actually in the parking lot of a Walmart. William Chapman was suspected of shoplifting. We still don't know if he actually stole anything. And after this brief struggle, the police officer, just like in Ferguson, claimed that William advanced towards him, was aggressive and threatened to overpower him. And so this officer shot William Chapman dead, and what struck me was surprise that this case had not attracted more attention.
When we checked last night on the website, The Counted, 785 people had been killed by the police in the United States so far this year. The U.S. remains on track to have more than 1,100 people killed by the police this year. Meanwhile, Saturday is the first anniversary of the death of 17-year-old Lennon Lacey, who was found hanging from a swing set in a majority white trailer park in the tiny town of Bladenboro, North Carolina, 1 year ago. Local authorities quickly ruled his death a suicide, a claim his family disputed. Lacey had been in a relationship with an older white woman who has said that they've often faced harassment for their interracial relationship. His death is still being investigated by the FBI as a possible lynching. On the economic justice front, the National Labor Relations Board has issued a ruling that could clear the way for fast food workers and other employees to collectively bargain with large corporations such as McDonald's, rather than with the individual franchises or subcontracting companies. The decision held that a California company called Browning Ferris Industries was a joint employer of the subcontracted workers who had been hired to staff its recycling center. The ruling means that a union representing those subcontracted workers now have the right to collectively bargain with the top company. Labor lawyers are saying that this could be one of the most significant rulings in the last 35 years. And finally, in our culture and media moment, the organization Appeal is holding an open house tonight. It's called It's All About Empowerment. It's going to be from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. And their announcement says, activate, engage, get involved, make a difference. They'll have a light dinner and a free raffle. Come join us for an evening of networking and empowerment. Get information on our informative classes on financial, cultural, and historical literacy, exciting new future events, and valuable details on how we can help you on your journey to empower yourself and strengthen your community. And that's going to be at the ACAS, Adinkra Cultural Arts Studio, 3804 34th Street in Mount Rainier, Maryland. For more information, you can call 800-711-7851 or email info@appealinc.org. That's info@appealinc.org. And also, the 15th Library of Congress National Book Festival will take place this Saturday, September 5th at the DC Convention Center and feature more than 170 authors, poets, illustrators, and special presenters. And so with a quick glance through the schedule, I noticed that it includes poets Kevin Young, Naomi Shihab Nye, as well as Ishmael Reed reading and signing from his new book, The Complete Muhammad Ali. On Pacifica's Letters and Politics show, Ishmael Reed said that his new book about Muhammad Ali explores Ali's political complexity.
He supported Ronald Reagan and some other athletes, some other boxers supported. I think we give a pass to athletes. I mean, for example, Ali helped to buffer the regime of Mobutu, the hated dictator of the Congo. One thing about this book is that it includes points of view that are left out of the other books.
Ishmael Reed's reading at the National Book Festival is scheduled to begin at 1:40 p.m. on Saturday and will be followed by a book signing. Also at 7:30 p.m., the Library of Congress, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Split This Rock are proud to present the second annual National Book Festival Youth Poetry Slam right there at the Convention Center at 7th and Mount Vernon Place here in Northwest D.C. And so those are our headlines and happenings. When we come back, voices of Katrina survivors who are heroes, not looters. Stay with us. Well, 10 years ago, on September 3rd, New Orleans, as well as a wide swath of the Gulf Coast, was still in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina and Rita and the breach of the levees that protected New Orleans. That disaster killed more than 1,800 people and left 80% of the city underwater. Here are voices from a video created at that time by Gloria LaRiva and the Answer Coalition titled Heroes, Not Looters.
Please send somebody to help us. Please send somebody to help us.
We have kids in here. We have dead bodies in the back. No one has been here. All we want is someone to show up and let us know what's going on.
Oh,
we haven't seen any buses. We haven't seen police.
They shouldn't treat us like this. What, they brought us over here for the killers? For the killers? For the killers?
Hurricane Katrina!
You still have dead bodies on the street. You're steady hearing of different white vigilante groups that's riding around in cars and trucks. You have all type of police coming down here believing that every young black person is a looter.
You have electricity?
Come see. This electricity right here.
Where's the fan from?
The fan that cools the radiator off, the engine off, in the car. Charge the phone up the same way by the car battery. It puts out enough juice, you know, like the car batteries, I mean the phone chargers that plug into the car. We use the same one. The only thing, we're going to have to cut the wires and put one on the hot and the negative ports.
The water was up to my chest at that time. When I was carrying that girl across the street, I mean, right next door, and then when I put her upstairs on this two-story pole, I went back to get this other girl. When I come back, she was dead, and then they still ain't picked up. She's in the back of a truck. I got her wrapped up in Visqueen, and then right down the street when we was walking, trying to get some ice and water. They had two dead people there. They had one sitting in a wheelchair wrapped up in a blanket and still sitting there. And Jerry? Yeah, it's rough up there.
Nasty.
The only thing I want to know is why my government ain't doing something for us. I'm a Vietnam vet. I deserve something.
You know, we lost everything. They still got all that stuff. So, you know, how I feel about the government, you know, everybody got to do what they got to do. That's how I feel, you know, I ain't really got too much to say about it. I lost everything. I can't find my mama, my children. Can't find none of that. So just me and my brother right now, so we got to do what we got to do.
Did you all know each other before the hurricane?
Yes, ma'am. We've been knowing each other. I've been knowing Roy for about 14 years. I've been knowing Terry about 10 years. And this is Roy's brother.
I just met them a couple days ago.
And nice meeting you.
It just, so you guys are sticking together in
this? Yes, ma'am. We gotta do something.
What is this truck here?
What is it?
Is this your truck?
Yes, our truck.
See, this one of my work truck for my job. We lost our vehicle underwater. I'm going back to work. They're gonna get their truck back, and I'm gonna get my own car.
Where do you all work?
In New Orleans. I work for Master Steel Erectors.
Depot calls.
I was a post person, valet, parking cars in the CBD.
And I do roofing work.
I had worked for Fisher's Roofing Incorporated, but I've been kind of laid up. I got a hernia right now. I need to get operated on, but I never did go to the doctor.
My experience in New Orleans, it was like hell on earth. I don't know what else to describe it. I was in the Superdome for 5 days, from Sunday to Thursday. And the stuff that went on in the Superdome is unexplainable. I really thought I wasn't going to make it out of there, really and truthfully. The toilet stopped up, urine and feces on the floor, trash piling up, babies dying because they don't have no milk. The people pushing and shoving just full of frustration. I ain't cried all I could. Out there crying, I ain't cried so much. It's just horrifying.
Went up in the attic, stayed in the attic. It was 10 of us, my aunt, my father, my mother, myself, my daughter, my brother. So we had the bus holes in the ceiling of the house and the whole roof for each of us to stand up and get fresh air. And we did that for 2 days. So a lot of people was airlifted from different houses that were screaming help. And I feel like they only was getting the people with small families. Because we screaming. We got an old lady, a pregnant lady. We have babies over here. And it was like, we only can help three at a time, only three at a time. But they never came.
You never came?
They never came.
How'd you get out?
My baby's dad came from, I don't know, with some boat, with some kind of rope tied around him, walking through like 5 feet of water. And I just couldn't believe it. So we all slid off the boat, him and some other guys. And we got off the boat, went through our neighborhoods on boat.
Did you sleep in those days that you were in the attic?
We started just to panic. And the looks in each other's eyes, as if we may never look at each other again, was horrible. And just to make 10 holes for 10 people to stand up and wonder who's going to go first, who's going to walk down and slip into the ceiling of the house and drown.
How many people did you save?
We saved approximately between 275 people to 325 people within 2 days, within 30 hours.
Just by putting them in the bug.
Air mattress the first day, 9 hours. Second day, 10 hours, boat. That we found. The only reason the Lord blessed us with the boat because someone with that boat had then took that boat to the drop-off point, got on a helicopter, left that boat. They had no means of getting that boat away. We dropped off the last load on the air mattress, saw the boat, realized nobody was using the boat, took it upon ourselves to say, they said we tried to start it up, the motor wasn't working. So we said, hey, instead of just leaving and jump back on the mattress, we need to start getting 20 and 30 people on one trip, even if it take us an extra 10 minutes. That's what we did. We took the rope, I got in the front, these three guys got in the back. We pushed, all we asked is when we picked up the family, if some of the guys are not afraid to get in the water, let's fill most of the boat up with the kids and the females, and the guys need to get in the boat. If you can't swim, don't get in the water. I didn't get on the boat at all, and I picked my family up last, on the last day. If I worked 30 hours, my family was on the boat the 29th hour in 30 minutes. So, but that was their job to cook our food, because if we just did it every day in those 2 days without nothing to put in our stomach, we would cramp up and we wouldn't be able to save all of those people.
Our main thing was just to help the kids and the children, but also help the grown folks. But our main concern was the women and the children, because without them, there'd be no us.
Did you know each other before?
Yeah, we grew up together. Went to the same schools together, played sports together. Bitty basketball, Pop Warner football. Been knowing these dudes.
And what neighborhood do you live in?
We live in the St. Bernard development. It's in Gentilly of New Orleans, which, as you know, Gentilly and the whole 9th Ward and the whole 7th Ward is basically gone.
been recognized by the city or any other officials?
No, no, not to now. This is our only, this is our first interview. And
but they might see us with a boat that ain't ours and call us looters too.
And we did what we had to do to survive and help other people to survive. So basically, we did what we had to do to help each other out.
Actually, Coast Guard members, once they finally started arriving, they were pulling on side of us, telling us, y'all heroes, dude. Telling us, we heroes.
Oh, I hear her roar when the going's low, and the water's up to the second floor.
Have you seen her? She got us with no fever, tell the Red Cross. These people need to get paid off.
Can't see her damage everywhere I go, and we need more than talk from a TV show.
Have you seen her? She got us with no fever, tell the Red Cross. These people need to get paid off.
Yeah. This goes out to all the family and may have lost a loved one in the Gulf region. Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi to Alabama, even Florida. Through the Hurricane Katrina, Rita or Wilma, you know what I'm talking about? Yeah. You can take me out of New Orleans, but you can't take New Orleans out of me. Until then, it's California love, West Side, LBC, baby. Creole shouting out, one love, one nation, one people.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition. I'm Esther Averam, and we just heard voices of heroes, not looters, who survived Hurricane Katrina, the destruction of their communities and families. When we come back, the attorney who has fought violence, murder, and torture by the state for decades, not in some foreign so-called dictatorship, but right here in the U.S. Stay with us. That was Ghost of Congo Square from Terrence Blanchard's 2007 album, A Tale of God's Will, Requiem for Katrina, that we are featuring today throughout the show. Earlier we heard Ghost of 1927 from the same album. Well, over the last 40 years in Chicago, dating back to the execution-style killing of Fred Hampton and other members of the Black Panther Party, Chicago has a long history of police torture in the black community. The exonerations of more than 110 wrongly convicted African-American men in Chicago recently, whose convictions were based on torture in the 1970s and 80s, occurred just this spring and summer. The victims are impacted, but also the lives of their children and grandchildren as well. And now in Chicago, there are these infamous so-called black sites of torture that have been exposed. And in response to this dismal state of the judicial system, Illinois became the first state in the union to establish law enforcement rules for police departments that utilize body cameras, establish reporting requirements for officers who make stops or arrests, crisis intervention and racial sensitivity training, and it prohibits excessive force like chokeholds. On August 12th, Governor Bruce Rauner passed the Police and Community Reform Act. The bill was written with the cooperation of the police union, the ACLU, and the NAACP, and is held up as a new national standard for the United States. And so in light of Chicago's decades of police abuse of authority, the new bill addresses some of the causes of this abuse and the more than 40 years of illegal police actions against mostly African Americans in Illinois. But questions remain about whether the bill, and it's called SB 1304, goes far enough to reform and improve law enforcement tactics in a nation where a startling number of those incarcerated and on death row are found to be innocent. Well, with me today to explore this history and current moment is attorney Flint Taylor. Flint Taylor is a founding partner of the People's Law Office in Chicago, which has been dedicated to litigating police violence, government misconduct, and death penalty cases for 45 years. Among the landmark cases that Taylor has litigated are the Fred Hampton Black Panther case, the Greenboro case against the Ku Klux Klan and Nazis, the Ford Heights 4 case, in which four wrongfully convicted men received a record $36 million settlement, and a series of cases arising from a pattern and practice of police torture and cover-up by former police commander John Burge, former mayor Richard M. Daley, and numerous other law enforcement officials. He obtained a multi-million dollar settlement for a 7-year-old boy who was falsely accused of the murder of an 11-year-old girl and has represented and continues to represent numerous other wrongfully convicted persons, including police torture victims who have spent decades in prison and on death row. Taylor's work in fighting against police torture in Chicago over the past 3 decades has been instrumental in obtaining conviction and imprisonment of John Burge, the precedent-setting decision that upheld the inclusion of former Mayor Daley as a defendant and reparations for the survivors of police torture. Welcome to On the Ground, Attorney Taylor.
Hello, it's nice to be with you.
So, yes, thank you again for being with us. So, I was just looking at some recent developments from these torture cases, and they're still in the news. So just last month, a murder conviction was overturned because the man convicted was tortured by police, Chicago police, into giving a false confession. And then I saw that your local CBS affiliate reported that the city had received 57 claims for reparations. And so I'm wondering, from your vantage point, have conditions in Chicago turned the corner with these reparations and this new law? Why don't we start with that?
Well, both of those are certainly significant. The man who was whose case was overturned last month is a client of ours, and we had fought that case for many years, like some of the others that you mentioned in your lead-in. The reparations is certainly a historic event. What has happened there was because of a very, very strong movement here connecting Black Lives Matter to a group called the Chicago Torture Justice Memorials, mm-hmm. and of course other activists fought very hard for reparations. And by reparations, what we were talking about and what we obtained was some financial relief for the men who were tortured, who had no legal remedy in court because these tortures took place so long ago. But as significantly, if not more so, they will also have access to psychological treatment, to education in the city colleges. Their families will as well. There'll be the torture and the history of torture will be taught in the Chicago public schools in the 8th and 10th grade. There'll be a memorial or memorials to the men who were tortured. Mm-hmm. All of that was obtained through several years of struggle. As I said, a real intergenerational and interracial fight that culminated in the city and the mayor, Rahm Emanuel, recognizing many, many decades after most of this torture took place, that it had in fact took place, apologizing for it, and making these amends to the the men who are still alive and the families of those who died.
Now, speaking of the reparations portion, the reports that I did read mentioned a $5 million fund. And just as an outsider looking at the case, that seemed extremely low for the number of victims. You know, we're so accustomed in hearing about court cases where an individual might get $5 million. Is that right, or is there more of a fund than that $5
million? It's a $5.5 million fund, but what people may not understand is these were men who had no legal remedy. There was no finding that they were wrongfully convicted. This was simply something that each man would get for the torture that he suffered.
Okay.
And it will be $100,000 per person that was tortured, who was tortured. So in one sense, that doesn't look like a huge amount of money. But on the other hand, there was no they had no legal remedy. The statute of limitations had run. The city didn't have to make any fund available. And they were compelled, because of the righteousness of the struggle, to make a significant amount of money available to the some 55 or 60 people who are going to partake in the reparations. And of course, there's more money involved because there's all the education. There's the center that's going to be set up on the south side of Chicago for treatment of torture victims, and there's going to be a memorial built. So all of that figured into it, both the financial and non-financial reparations. So what at first blush may look like a small amount, and I'm not saying that $100,000 is enough to compensate for torture, even if you did commit the crime you were convicted for. But on the other hand, it is significant, and you have to look at it in light of the fact that there was no legal remedy that any of these men had.
So why don't you explain that to us, because I know you're talking about a statute of limitations. I understand that because the torture happened so long ago, they had no legal recourse. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. The law is such that if you're exonerated, let's say you're tortured, you give a confession, the confession is used against you, and ultimately a court says you were wrongfully convicted and cut you loose, then in those limited circumstances, you can sue at the end of all of that process. So that's why you see some men getting large amounts of money. They're the ones who were exonerated. They were found to be innocent, and when they were found to be innocent, they could file a lawsuit.
Right.
And that often happened in the last few years. So those men are, quote, more fortunate, end quote, than the men who got the reparations. Those men were never found innocent by a court. The only thing they had going for them, so to speak, is that they had evidence that they were tortured back in the 1970s or the 1980s. So the statute of limitations on those cases, because they have not been exonerated or found to have been innocent or wrongfully convicted, ran many decades ago. So it is
okay.
Something beyond the legal system is what the reparations are. It has nothing to do with the courts. It has to do with the movement and the city making amends as a matter of principle. Sort
right.
of like, you know, that's why it's called reparations. If you think about it in terms of the broader struggle that's been fought and continues to be fought around reparations for enslaved people, there's no, quote, legal right at this point. But on the other hand, there's overwhelming principle there of right and wrong, of morality, of ethics, and all of that.
Right. And just one more point on that. So given like projects like the Exoneration Project and other research being done to look into old cases where people may have been convicted wrongly, there's still a chance for these people who have not been exonerated to be exonerated.
Yes. Of course, the people in prison, many of them are still fighting their cases. And as you mentioned, we were just one a case for one of the men who had been in prison for 25 years. Now there's a special prosecutor that defends these cases for the police and the state. He has to decide whether to appeal this to the Illinois Supreme Court or not. And, of course, we're hopeful that community pressure and that he will not appeal, and this man will get out. He then, if he is in fact gets out and is exonerated behind this case, he would have the right to sue. That he's in a different situation than the men who are getting reparations.
Okay, now we're going to go to a brief break. And when we come back, we're going to invite listeners to call in. We have on our show, Attorney Taylor, we have callers who join us in discussion. So after the break, we're going to open the lines, and you can join our discussion by calling 202-588-0893. That's 202-588-0893. We're talking about the torture cases in Chicago, the city's long history of police torture, abuse, murder, particularly in the African-American community. But really, we're going to obviously talk about the larger issues that are facing us in the country right now and the opening motions that we heard just yesterday in Baltimore in the case of the death of Freddie Gray. So stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition. I'm Esther Averam, and I'm in conversation with Attorney Flint Taylor of Chicago. And we're talking about not only the torture cases, police cases in Chicago, but we're going to kind of open it up and talk about what's happening here, you know, nationally and also here in the DMV with the case of the officers in Baltimore accused in the death of Freddie Gray. And you can join the discussion by calling 202-588-0893. I do have a caller, and I want to go to that caller now. Just say your first name and where you're calling from.
All right. It's Rick from D.C.
Good morning, Rick.
Good morning. Thank you so much again for another out of the ballpark show. You're great. You're great. Love it. And I like to thank the your guests for all of the work and the contributions that he's made, and others toward pointing out pointing out the injustice that exists. But true justice really exists only when people have food and shelter and jobs and income and housing and all of those things. And until that happens, there will be no justice. Yes, we can tweak around what the police do. The police work for the people who made those conditions like mm-hmm. that for us. And mm-hmm. and so that's the problem there. We can tweak the police department. We can tweak the laws. But until we do something about people's misery from trying to eke out a life in America today is something that needs to be addressed immediately. Thank you.
Okay, and thank you for calling, making those links between physical violence and economic violence. So, Attorney Taylor, can you tell me a little bit about the case of your client who just had his conviction overturned last month?
That case, and we have another case that's pending right now in the criminal courts that the judge is about to rule on, where we're seeking an exoneration of a man who was tortured. The case that you mentioned, the man was convicted almost solely on a confession that he said was tortured from him. He said, and this
what was his name?
His name is Sean Wuerl, mm-hmm. and he, as I said, had spent close to 25 years in the penitentiary. We were able to get the courts to recognize his right to have a hearing then we put on a hearing. And what we're finding out in Chicago is that these detectives who participated in the torture are now, when they're called to testify for the state and against the victims such as Wuerl, they don't testify. They don't deny that they did it. They take the Fifth Amendment. And by taking the Fifth Amendment, what they're saying, in essence, is, I don't want to testify about this because if I do, I will be under oath and the powers that be may investigate me and charge me with perjury for lying about whether I was involved in torture. And that's exactly what happened with the main man who led the torture out here, John Burge. After many years, he was charged and convicted of perjury, not of torture, but of perjury because he lied about whether he tortured people. So now these other cops are doing the same thing. So when we had our hearing, Sean Wuerl testified that he'd been tortured, and in response, the state could put on no evidence because the only evidence they had was the Fifth Amendment being taken by their detective, which we showed the court. We called him to the stand. But the judge, the problem we have in Chicago, among others, is many of the judges who were in prosecutors back when the torture took place have been promoted, so to speak, to judge. So it's very hard to get a fair hearing in the courts of Cook County. And this judge chose to say that Mr. Wuerl was not believable, and he didn't focus at all on the fact that there was no evidence that the state could put on or on the fact that the Fifth Amendment had been invoked in this hearing. And the appeals court, when it heard the case back this summer, said that was all wrong. Right. Said that the focus was wrong. The focus should have been on the detective, on the fact he took the Fifth Amendment, and on the fact he was one of Burge's main compatriots, that he had worked for many years with Burge. He had other cases where torture, we showed he was involved in torture of other men. So the appeals court said the judge got it wrong, and that Mr. Wuerl should have a new trial. And, of course, if there's a new trial, that confession that he made will not be part of it. And without a confession, there's no other evidence against him. So that's why the prosecutor, if he were ethical, should dismiss the case now. But he's contemplating whether to take it to a higher court, that being the Illinois Supreme Court, to try to argue that the appellate court was wrong in deciding for us. So it seems to be never-ending sometimes. But we do have the victories along the way, and this was another victory. And hopefully either by winning in the Supreme Court or by the prosecutor doing the right thing, Mr. Wuerl will be on a free man fairly soon.
Now, you have another client, and I was looking at his video online, Daryl Cannon. Now, in his case, was his situation just the torture, or was he also exonerated of charges?
Well, he was ultimately exonerated, although the state never admitted that he was, quote, innocent. After 24 years in the penitentiary, we were able to, through a hearing that we had that showed that he was tortured into giving a false confession, we were able to get him released. And the state dismissed his case. But the state sometimes does not admit that a man was exonerated or say he was innocent even when they dismiss the case.
Wow.
So in Daryl's case, it was dismissed, and in our view, it exonerated him, but there's never been, and the state's never admitted that they wrongfully prosecuted him. They just dismissed his case after 24 years in the penitentiary.
Well, so we have a clip of Daryl Cannon talking about just a portion of his ordeal with the Chicago police.
The other side of the back door opened the door, and he came in, and they made me sit down, and my hands was up in the air. And he grabbed them. After I sit down, he grabbed them. And so they pulled me back, made me lay down. And he had to handcuff my hands so I couldn't rise back up. And it was Sergeant Burns that first used the electric caliper on me. And at that time, He stuck it to my testicles, and I remember trying to kick him, and in the process of trying to kick him, they ended up, Dignit was trying to step on one of my feet, Burns was trying to step on the other one, and they kept hitting me with the caliper.
Wow, so that's the voice of Daryl Cannon talking about his torture at the hands of Chicago police. And so he has been released, but he hasn't been exonerated. So he isn't able to kind of sue or anything or take his case further, but he is able to receive these reparations from Chicago. Attorney Taylor?
Yes, he is, and he will receive reparations. And he also has become a major spokesperson for the reparations movement and for the anti-torture movement in general. He is a wonderful leader in all of this, and everyone has a tremendous amount of respect for him. He not only did 24 years, but he did 9 of those in a supermax prison, the TAMS prison here in Illinois, which has since been shut down, which was a form of torture in of itself. So he was tortured to go to the penitentiary, and then he was tortured in the penitentiary. So Daryl is a living testament to the strength of men who go through these unspeakable crimes against humanity.
Okay, I think we do have another caller. And so, caller, just say your first name and where you're calling from.
Brooklyn Cubs from D.C. The first thing I want to say, sister, is I've been following that Chicago case with Mr. Burge from its inception, and it's horrendous. And that's why 6 more weeks before justice will. All black men, all black women, and all people who are seeking justice should be on that mall with the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. Because this has got to stop. John Burge got to keep his pension for torturing black men. Torturing us. And this has got to stop in America. And if you're not ready to fight, as I heard the minister say, if you're not ready to fight, stay at home. You don't want no cowards on that mall.
Okay.
And I appreciate the lawyer for doing what he's doing. Thank you very much, sir.
Well, thank you.
Okay. Thank you for that call. So, Attorney Taylor, what can you tell me about the Police Community Reform Bill? This is new legislation, and I know a variety of people came together to create it, and they're calling it it could be a national model. It could be a set the national standard for ways of addressing the criminal justice system. So what do you think?
Well, I thought it was interesting what the first caller said in terms of, you know, that you have to deal with the fundamental issues of poverty and racism and injustice, that some of the reforms are just that they will change some things, but they don't get at the fundamental problems. Certainly, the camera issue is an important issue that was fought for in Ferguson, and what they did in Ferguson was they supplied the community with body cameras instead of the police. You look at the act, and of course the officer still has to turn on the camera, which you know, it may or may not happen in situations. We see that even when there are cameras, often the brutality still happens. So the cameras are not a cure-all. They're certainly a step forward. The fact that they are going to have to report the brutality and the deaths, that's a step forward. It's certainly important to have a register of all the deaths around the country caused by the police. The fact that there is going to be, that it bars chokeholds, well, that should have been done a long time ago. But then we see what happened out with Eric Garner, and even though those kinds of things are barred in regulations, that doesn't mean that they don't happen, and that they don't happen on camera is, of course, what happened with Eric Garner. So it could be a model. It certainly are steps forward. I think it was fought for by progressive forces in the legislature, as well as the NAACP and the ACLU here in this state. But I think that if you ask the young people on the street, if you ask the Black Lives Matter movement, if you ask We Charge Genocide movement, which was so strong in support of the reparations here in the city of Chicago, I'm sure they would have an analysis that would go far beyond the provisions of the Illinois Act, and that, of course, would talk about the school-to-prison pipeline and all of that, which is so fundamental to the injustice and racism in the criminal justice system.
Okay. Well, you know, before we end, I do have to ask you if you've been following any of the pretrial motions in the case of the death of Freddie Gray, and if you had any thoughts.
Yes, I have been following them, and I think that I have a lot of respect for the prosecutor out there in Baltimore County. I think that the judge, of course, did the right thing in denying the motions to dismiss the charges, and also to dismiss the trumped up theory that the prosecutor somehow had a conflict of interest. These cases, however, are very difficult to win when the prosecutor takes them on. I know you're doing a tremendous feature on Katrina. I heard that when I first came on, and of course, when you look at what happened in the cases out of Katrina, the murders by the police on the bridge and the murders of the Glover and burning his body, even though there were the feds got convictions in those cases, the higher courts reversed them. They got new trials. I mean, there's just so many hurdles to get over when you have an honest prosecutor like you have in Baltimore. That she and her people are going to have to overcome to ultimately put these men behind bars. But on the other hand, it is a beacon across the country, the same way that the reparations are, that things can be done, that racism and police brutality and police violence can be fought against if there's a strong movement and if there's exposure by people who want to change that system.
Okay. I've been speaking with Attorney Flint Taylor, founding partner of the People's Law Office in Chicago, which has been dedicated to litigating police violence, government misconduct, and death penalty cases for 45 years. Thank you for joining me, Attorney Taylor.
I enjoyed it very much. You take care now. Okay.
And so that will do it for us on Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition. I'm Esther Avarim, and I want to thank again my guest, Attorney Flint Taylor. Thanks to Zeph Ernest for his production of that Chicago segment and to the entire On the Ground team. And thanks to our engineer, Michael Nasella. Thank you so much for listening and supporting your station for Jazz and Justice. You can reach the show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can now listen to all of our shows and past shows. Please like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On the Ground Show. You can also contact us at our website. Now stay tuned for the news, followed by Krista Property on the Thursday edition of Don't Forget the Blues. Raise your voice. Peace. I'm gonna go get some more.